So if you look around today, there's this feeling, isn't there, almost universal, that the core systems we depend on, housing, healthcare, maybe even just basic political trust, they feel fundamentally broken somehow.
Yeah, like the rules aren't quite working for everyone.
Exactly. It feels like the rules are written for, a select few, and the rest of us are just constantly trying to catch up. Today, we're not just confirming that feeling, we're actually diving into the structure that seems to create it. The sources we've looked at give us this really comprehensive framework. It names this dynamic, this thing happening in modern political economy. They call it the racket.
Right. And what's really crucial about this definition, this idea of the racket, is that we're not talking about some, secret criminal thing, like the mafia hiding in the shadows.
Not a conspiracy theory.
No. This modern racket, it's usually legal, it's institutionalized, often it's even disguised as like efficiency or innovation.
Okay, so how do they define it then?
Well, we define the racket as a system of engineered dependency. This is key. Harm and profit are designed to be codependent. They're not just happening side by side by accident.
Codependent, so one relies on the other.
Precisely. Think about the old protection rackets, right? The mob profits by protecting you from violence. Violence they might actually be creating or threatening themselves.
Okay, I get that analogy.
So apply that same logic to modern systems. Maybe it's dependency on certain drugs that benefits pharmaceutical companies, or financial systems built to be so complex, so opaque, that only insiders profit. You start to see the structure isn't really malfunctioning.
It's working exactly like it's supposed to.
Exactly. It's designed to pull value to generate profit from vulnerability. Sometimes vulnerability it helps create.
Wow, that distinction, harm and profit being designed together, that's really powerful. It makes you think that just fixing the service problems won't work, right?
That's exactly right. The system just keeps generating the same symptoms because the underlying rules, the drivers, they're optimized for this extraction.
So if it's designed this way, we need a proper blueprint. We need to understand all the layers to figure out how to maybe redesign it.
And the sources give us that. It's a really illuminating four-layer causal framework for analysis. It's basically our roadmap for this deep dive.
Okay, four layers. Let's break them down.
We're going to trace these dynamics right from the, the stuff we see every day, the symptoms,
Yeah.
all the way down to the deepest root cause, the fundamental error.
Right, so layer one.
We start with the surface mechanisms. These are the symptoms, the daily stuff.
Okay.
Then we go deeper to the structural drivers. Think of these as the engines, the institutional rules making extraction seem rational, even necessary.
Got it. Engines.
Layer three explores the metastructural grammars. These are the deep cultural stories, the assumptions that make us think, oh, well, that's just how things are, that make it seem like common sense.
The narratives that normalize it.
Exactly. And finally, layer four, we drill right down to the axiological roots. This is where the framework argues the fundamental mistake lies how we even define value in the first place.
Okay, surface, structures, stories, and roots. Let's start at the top then. The surface.
Let's do it.
So, surface mechanisms. We're talking about the obvious things, right? The practices that make people lose trust. What's like the most visible example of this modern racket in action?
Oh, it's got to be regulatory capture, often working hand in hand with legal shielding.
Regulatory capture. That's when the watchdog gets captured by the industry it's watching.
Pretty much. The public institutions meant to oversee industries, they end up dominated by the interests they're supposed to regulate. You see with the whole revolving door thing, right? Regulators leave their jobs and walk straight into high-paying gigs in the industry they just oversaw.
Yeah, we hear about that a lot.
And the opioid epidemic is just a devastating example. Purdue Pharma, back in 95, they got FDA approval for OxyContin. But the scrutiny, well, by all accounts, it was seriously lacking when it came to the addiction risks.
And did that revolving door play a part?
Oh, absolutely. Former FDA reviewers later ended up working for the very companies they were supposed to be keeping an eye on. So the body meant to protect the public, it sort of became an enabler for private profit.
And then when the harm became undeniable, the legal system didn't really deliver justice. It provided cover instead.
That's the legal shielding part. Look at the Sackler family, who owned Purdue. They used bankruptcy law, which is supposed to be for, giving failed businesses a fresh start. They use it to try and get immunity from all the civil lawsuits.
So they could protect their wealth.
Essentially, yes. They offered settlements, huge sums of money, sure, but still way below the estimated cost, the damage done to society. These legal shields basically make sure that systemic harms get pushed onto the public while the profits stay safely private.
Okay, so controlling the rulemakers is one thing. What about controlling the market itself, creating bottlenecks where you just have to pay?
That's the monopoly power piece, or oligopoly, often. Think about a company like Amazon. By the early 2020s, they controlled, what, something like 40% of U.S. e-commerce?
Huge market share.
Right. And crucially, they charge third-party sellers hefty fees, sometimes up to 30% of their sales, just for access to that marketplace. This isn't just about being good at business. It's like imposing a private tax on global commerce. If you're a small business, you almost have to be on Amazon.
So your dominance turns into unavoidable rent extraction.
Exactly.
Choke points.
Okay, so we've seen the symptoms: capture, legal loopholes, monopolies, gouging. But you're saying these things keep popping up because of deeper rules. Let's go down a level then to the structural drivers, the engines behind it all.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting. Probably the most powerful structural driver is something we can call single metric optimization.
Single metric, like focusing on just one number? Precisely. Our big institutions, governments, corporations, they often fixate on just one metric. For nations, it's usually GDP, right? Gross domestic product. For companies, it's almost always shareholder value.
Profit above all else.
And this intense focus, this reduction, it systematically pushes aside other crucial values, multidimensional life values, things like, ecological health, worker safety, community well-being. They just don't fit the main metric.
And the Boeing 737MX crisis. That feels like a chilling example of this.
It really is. The sources lay it out starkly. Between 2013 and 2019, Boeing spent over $40 billion on stock buybacks.
$40 billion with a B.
Yep, designed specifically to boost the share price, which in turn boosts executive pay. Meanwhile, corners were being cut on safety investments, on training, things directly related to their core job of flying people safely.
And that contributed to the crashes.
Directly. Two crashes, 346 lives lost. Prioritizing shareholder value wasn't just an unfortunate side effect, it was structurally incentivized over the fundamental purpose of the company.
Wait, just to pause on that. $40 billion on buybacks instead of safety. That's not just an error. That sounds like the system demanding that financial priorities trump human life.
That's the argument. It's a systemic mandate. And that mandate gets reinforced by another huge structural driver: the way our money system works, specifically debt-based money, and the growth imperative that comes with it.
How does the money system force growth?
Well, most money isn't created by governments printing it. It's created when private banks make loans, and loans require interest payments. So just to pay back the interest on all the existing debt, the economy has to keep growing.
So if growth stops.
The whole system risks collapse. It means extraction. Finding new ways to generate profit and service debt isn't just an option for businesses. It's almost a structural necessity baked into the monetary system itself.
You can really see that dependency playing out in things like the student debt crisis, can't you?
Absolutely. Look at the U.S., what is it, $1.7 trillion in outstanding student debt. Education is basically essential for a decent life now, but it's been turned into this massive funnel for creditor value.
Trapping people for
decades. Graduates are locked into repayment schedules. It shapes their life choices, and it guarantees this continuous flow of value back to the financial system. It's a perfect example of engineered dependency, sold as an investment in your future.
Okay, and there's one more structural engine you mentioned, something about global rules.
Yes, intellectual property or IP architectures, especially how they work globally.
Right, patents, copyrights.
Exactly. And this really came into sharp focus during the COVID-19 pandemic. Remember the debate about waiving patent rights for vaccines?
The trip desk waivers, yeah.
Billions in public money went into developing those vaccines. Yet the big pharmaceutical companies fought hard against waiving the IP rights of the World Trade Organization to protect their profits, fundamentally. Even though arguably sharing that knowledge faster could have ended the pandemic sooner for billions, especially in the Global South. But the global IP rules treated life-saving medical knowledge primarily as a private commodity for rent extraction, not as a public good.
Okay, so we've gone from the visible stuff like capture and monopolies down through the institutional rules like shareholder value and debt. Now you're saying we need to go even deeper into the mind of the racket, so to speak. Section three, metastructural grammars. That still sounds a bit academic. Can you unpack that? What are these deep stories?
Yeah, metastructural grammars is just a way of talking about the underlying cultural logics, the shared narratives, the assumptions, the things we take for granted that actually justify the extraction and make it seem normal.
Like the water we swim in.
Kind of, yeah. They're the stories we tell ourselves about how the economy has to work or how the world is. And one of the deepest, most powerful ones is this unspoken belief that price equals value.
Price equals value. So if something costs a lot, it must be valuable.
Exactly. And conversely, if something doesn't have a market price like clean air or care work or biodiversity, it becomes invisible to the economic system. Or worse, it becomes something to be exploited because it's free. This grammar basically makes real-life value secondary to financial numbers.
Can you give an example, something that maybe didn't have a price but then got pulled into that logic?
Sure. Think about water. Essential for life, right? Non-substitutable. But in 2020, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange started trading water futures contracts based on California's water prices.
Trading water like oil or gold.
Precisely. Overnight, this absolute necessity for life was reduced to a tradable asset, something for financial institutions to speculate on, to bet on its future scarcity. That's the price. Value grammar in action, legitimizing the financialization of absolutely essential things.
And that core belief, price, value, it gets reinforced by maybe the ultimate narrative weapon, the one that just shuts down alternatives.
You mean Tina?
Yeah, Tina.
Margaret Thatcher's famous line, "There is no alternative." Tina basically frames the current system, market dominance, constant growth, private solutions for everything, as inescapable reality. Like it's a law of nature, not a set of choices.
And if people believe there's no alternative,
they won't seriously challenge the fundamental structures. They might tinker around the edges, but they won't question the core logic. Tina is incredibly powerful for insulating the racket from systemic change. It thrives on that feeling of inevitability.
So Tina locks us into the present system. How do our economic models themselves justify sacrificing the future for today's game? Is there a mechanism for that too?
Oh, yes. It's called discounting the future. It's standard practice in economic modeling.
Discounting the future, what does that mean?
It means that benefits and costs that occur further in the future are systematically given less weight, less value than benefits and costs happening today. The present is always prioritized.
Which basically justifies short-term thinking and long-term harm.
Exactly. It allows us to make decisions that benefit us now, even if we know they'll cause huge problems down the line for future generations or the planet.
Is there a number, like a concrete example of this?
Well, here's one that should make everyone pause. The IMF reported recently, I think it was 2023, that globally, governments provide over $7 trillion every year in subsidies for fossil fuels, both direct and indirect.
$7 trillion annually.
Annually. That's actively using economic policy to prop up carbon-intensive industries, locking us into damaging paths, prioritizing immediate, measurable growth over long-term planetary health and stability. It's like an economic green light for sacrificing the future.
That $7 trillion figure is just staggering. It really shows how deep that short-term growth push goes.
Okay. We've done symptoms, engines, stories. Now we're at the bottom layer, axiological roots. The fundamental error, you said. Is axiological just a fancy way of saying what we value?
It's a bit more precise. Axiology is the philosophical study of value. And the root error identified in our sources is what they call the inversion of value. Inversion, like upside down.
Exactly. Societies, especially modern economies, have ended up optimizing for the growth of money and financial assets, rather than for what the sources call life coherence. We've started confusing the symbols money, stocks, abstract numbers with the real things they're supposed to represent, the actual necessities for life.
Where does this inversion show up most clearly? Where does the symbol totally dominate reality?
It's captured in a concept the source has called the spectral ontology of value.
Spectral, like ghostly.
Yeah, ghost-like. Think about it. Trillions of dollars in value now exist in highly speculative assets. Things like certain cryptocurrencies, complex derivatives, assets that are layers removed from any tangible production or real-world use.
Purely abstract wealth.
Right. They're like ghostly claims on value, often generated with very little connection to material reality or ecological limits. Yet the ups and downs of these spectral assets dictate real-world investment decisions, where capital flows, who gets hired or fired. These symbolic claims are disciplining the real economy, proving that money growth itself has become the ultimate goal, detached from actually sustaining life.
So if the root problem is this deep, this philosophical almost, then the solution can't just be, I don't know, a new regulation here or there. It has to be more fundamental.
It has to be. The framework argues we need to re-anchor the entire system in what it calls life value coherence.
Life value coherence. Okay, yeah. What's the principle?
It proposes a clear standard, the primary axiom of value.
Yeah.
Basically, that which enabled life to flourish universally necessary things like clean air, safe water, essential care, shelter that's fundamentally good. That which disables or destroys life is fundamentally bad.
And the key point is...
The key insight is that these core life necessities are non-substitutable. You can't swap breathable air for more cryptocurrency. No amount of financial wealth compensates for losing the ecological systems that support life.
That feels intuitively right, but it sounds like a huge shift from how things operate now. Are there any real-world examples, places trying to actually do this?
Well, it's starting. The ideas are being applied. Look at the well-being economy governments, the WeGo Alliance places like Scotland, New Zealand, Iceland, Wales, Finland.
I've heard of that.
They're actively trying to move beyond GDP as the main measure of progress. They're developing well-being dashboards with multiple indicators, health outcomes, environmental sustainability, social equity, and trying to align their budgets and economic policies with improving those real-life outcomes.
So shifting the goalposts from just money growth to actual human and planetary flourishing.
That's the aim. It's about moving towards that life value, coherence, and practical policy.
Okay, this framework, surface, structure, grammar, root, it's really powerful for analysis. To kind of bring it all together, maybe we could trace one specific crisis through all four layers, show how they connect. What about, say, the housing crisis? That affects so many people.
Yeah, housing is a perfect case study. You can see the whole cascade.
Okay, start at the bottom, the axiological root.
The root issue is that the fundamental value of shelter, of having a home, has been displaced by asset appreciation. Housing is treated first and foremost as an investment vehicle, a way to grow wealth. Its symbolic financial value has overtaken its real use value as a life necessity.
Right. It's less about living in it, more about its price going up.
Exactly. Then the metastructural grammar that supports this, speculation, flipping houses, rent seeking, it's all normalized as smart investment or wealth creation. Homelessness or unaffordability become seen as maybe unfortunate side effects, not direct outcomes of that core value choice.
What about the structures, the engines?
The structural drivers lock it in place. Things like mortgage finance systems that encourage ever-increasing debt loads. Restrictive zoning laws, often designed to limit supply and keep property values high. Tax codes that favor property owners over renters.
All pushing prices up and reinforcing the investment angle.
Right. And then you see the predictable results at the surface mechanisms level. Skyrocketing rents, rent gouging, homes sitting empty as speculative assets, ghost homes, mass evictions, rising homelessness. Often side by side with booming luxury construction, all symptoms of that deeper value inversion.
And that shows why, just say, putting a cap on rents, a surface fix, might not work long term if the root belief is still that housing's main job is to make money.
Precisely. The racket, in whatever form, endures because it's a systemic thing. It's a pattern that repeats across layers, all stemming from that misspecified idea of value. To really change it, you need interventions that work across all four levels simultaneously. You need to change the goal, change the story, change the rules, and change the visible practices.
It requires a whole system perspective.
Definitely.
Wow. Okay, so this has been quite the deep dive, mapping out this racket to regeneration framework. We went from the surface stuff, everyone sees the capture, the monopolies, through the engines like shareholder rules and debt, down through the cultural stories like Tinana and discounting the future, right to the very bottom, that core axiological error of putting financial growth ahead of life itself.
Yeah, and the sources really stress that this framework isn't just academic. It's intended as a diagnostic tool, something you, the listener, can use. We've touched on climate, health, housing, but the real power comes when you apply it yourself.
So a challenge for our listeners.
Exactly. We want to leave you with this question to think about. Take any sector you interact with regularly. Maybe it's your local food system, how food gets to your table, or maybe how media and news reach you, or even your own workplace dynamics. Try to analyze it using these four layers.
Surface mechanisms, structural drivers, metastructural grammars, and axiological roots.
Right. See if you can spot the patterns.
Yeah.
And then ask yourself, if you could make one change, but make it at the root level, at that axiological, what we value level, what redesign would you propose to shift that system more towards life coherence?
That's a great reflective question. It really brings it home. And the final thought is, I guess, one of agency.
Yes. Hmm. Remember, the racket, however entrenched it feels, it isn't destiny. It's a design. And designs can be understood, they can be critiqued, and ultimately they can be consciously reauthored. Oh. We can choose to design for life, not just for profit.